your new best friends. You're gonna find the book you love to pieces. The girl behind the counter recommends dollar books and shelves of graphic novels. Titles old and new, you'll find them all. With action figures, board games, toys, and models to add to your new Comic Wednesday haul. The Comic Book Store, the Comic Book Store. Cause that's where the books live, but it's also much more. It's the heart of the art form that we all adore. Your friendly neighborhood comic book store.
Hello there. Welcome back to Source Material Live. I'm your host, the Mandated Reporter, and frankly, I'm mortified, Mr. Mark Rattledge. And we are celebrating the 10th anniversary release of Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, which is back in theaters. It was came out 10 years ago. They put it back in the theaters for people to enjoy. I took my kids to go see it. And we are building up to that later this week. This Thursday, myself and my guest for tonight will be reviewing that movie as an on-trial. Actually, it's going to be he's going to gush about it, and I'm going to politely make a comment or two, and then I'm going to hide under a rock before I get beaten to death. As I've said, amongst the people that I communicate and podcast with, it's fucking Schindler's List, Citizen Kane, Scott Pilgrim. But that's the main event of this week. We are beginning with where it all started. The first two volumes of the Scott Pilgrim comic book series. Scott Pilgrim started its life out as a series of graphic novels by Canadian author and artist Brian Lee O'Malley. This series is about Scott Pilgrim, a slacker and part-time musician who lives in Toronto and plays bass guitar in a band. He falls in love with an American delivery girl named Ramona Flowers, but he must defeat her seven evil exes in order to date her. And so tonight, these were, again, released as six individual digests and then rebound as the Scott Pilgrim Color Collection, Volumes 1, 2, and 3. And so Scott Pilgrim's Precious Little Life and Scott Pilgrim vs. the World were in Color Collection 1. That's what we're talking about tonight. And here to help me do that is Scott Pilgrim enthusiast, Mr. Sean Comer. How do you do, sir?
You sound almost so put upon by the fact that I have brought this masterpiece to your doorstep.
But no, not at all.
Hell, man.
No, I am not in the least bit put upon. I am excited to talk about all these things. You know what it was? It was one of those things where I don't have a personal relationship to the film. I barely remember watching it the first time when it came out, mm-hmm. if I even got all the way through it. And so I don't have the personal connection that apparently many of you did. And so it's me kind of reacting to the I can't, you know, sometimes it's hard to muster enthusiasm for any of the things that we talk about outside of a Marvel or a Star Wars show. And then I brought this up just as an aside because we were talking about Nintendo Core, which brought us to Anna Managuchi, which brought us to Scott Pilgrim. And it was all of a sudden I got this, like, flood of, oh, my God, Scott Pilgrim. And I'm like, I had no idea this was as popular as it was. I really didn't. That's really all I'm reacting to in my funny way.
We are Source Material. We are here to make you think about death and get sad and stuff.
1, 2, 3, 4. So let me ask you. Is this the first time you've read the comics? Were you aware of the comics when the movie came out?
Oh, far from the first time that I've read them. And I had not read them when the movie came out. I was kind of brought to the movie by my longtime best friend, Jess. In fact, this is kind of... The movie is a big part of our bond. It's not just a big source of our inside jokes and quips when we're chatting. It's something that we just kind of hold near and dear to our friendship as something else that brought us together. And the funny thing is, when I watched it the first time, I was at best pretty ambivalent toward it.
Okay.
I think because at the time when I watched it, there was a little bit of tension, a little bit of distance between she and I. And later, it's just a quirk of mine that sometimes I will experience an absolutely brilliant creative work and not really be open-minded enough to give it its due just because I'm watching it in absolutely the wrong frame of mind.
Sure, I get that.
Yeah. And so later, after the waters had kind of stilled and the dust had cleared, I watched it again, completely independently. And it was like experiencing it 100% fresh. I absolutely fell in love with every little aspect of it. Everything from the cast to the music to the nerd jokes, the action, obviously, the incredible dialogue, all of it. And then a few years later, I actually did pick up the books. In fact, I got the original 6-volume series, which, go ahead, hate me for this opinion, I really prefer it over the 3-volume colorized version.
No, these are the original 6-issue black and whites.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I mean, it kind of goes color about halfway through.
Okay.
It's because when O'Malley was first putting this together, he initially opted for black and white simply because it was less expensive. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to embrace the black and white manga aesthetic, to use his words, that inspired him in the early 2000s when he had read Ranma ½ and decided that he wanted to produce his own shonen-style comic book series for the West, despite the fact that the medium had not really quite yet achieved massive mainstream popularity in North America. He read Even a Monkey Can Draw manga by Koji Ehara and Kentaro Takekuma. I apologize if I butchered the pronunciation. Which he was introduced to in 2002 by his roommate, who worked in a comic store. He read it while he was working on another acclaimed series, Lost at Sea. And from there, he started planning out Scott Pilgrim. And that was informed in turn, which is especially notable for those who are as huge a fans of the original motion picture soundtrack, original, so to speak. I should say just the movie soundtrack, the OST. By the kind of bittersweetly peppy single Scott Pilgrim by Plumtree. Especially by the lyric "I've liked you for 1,000 years." I mean that has connotations that just run all the way through nearly just a full at least half the characters in this entire damn saga. But yeah, and somewhere in between there, I think the order was saw the movie the first time, was pretty meh towards it. Saw the movie the second time, absolutely adored it, and then I played the video game adaptation of the, you know, of the book series. And God, what a delightful, bombastic little throwback that is, and what a love letter to the books as well. And then finally, sometime shortly after that, I ended up reading the books. And I'll tell you right off from Jump Street, what I like about the books, the black and white books, the original 6 volumes as opposed to the color series, is the pacing. There's something that I absolutely that I absolutely fell in love with about the fact that it's, for one thing, about the length of your typical shonen manga. I know this because I am engaged to a delightful otaku who can plow through a manga the way I can go through a volume of Green Lantern just like it's like scarfing a can of Pringles or Doritos for her, or shotgunning a beer, the way she can burn through manga. So they're really well paced out. The story is just kind of metered and exactly when it needs to, usually on just kind of a perfect cliffhanger. And it makes for, each volume makes for a really satisfying kind of self-contained read. Whereas I feel like that was a little bit lost in the color version. I know they meant well by kind of reducing it to three volumes instead of two. But yeah, I don't know. You know, it's that whole you never forget your first thing. Sometimes you can see a remake or a rehash or a re-recording, whatever, of something that you love, and you can kind of admire it and say, yeah, you know what? That does right by its inspiration. Good on you. But sometimes you just yearn for kind of all of those kind of nascent imperfections of the original, of the way you came to it. You know, those footsteps are just so much more familiar. And that's a good way to put it. It's a little bit like you've got this sprawling, gorgeous forest in front of you. That one that you've just kind of grown up traversing. You know, you know every bend in the trail, every tree, every hill, every little curve in the creek. And then you come upon it years later and you find that somebody took that beaten, weathered path that you always used to walk, and instead they've added this really accommodating, smooth, well-maintained asphalt. And you can appreciate it for what it is, for the improvement, but at the same time it's never going to strike all the same chords as what you came away so familiar with originally. So
the first volume here starts off with Scott Pilgrim's Precious Little Life. A couple of things before we jump into this. One, I did not realize that the entire six-volume series is what makes up the movie. So, you know, it's called Scott Pilgrim versus the World. And, again, I haven't read these before. And I'm only going by the first two volumes, so if I'm a little off on this, feel free to explain what I'm missing here. But having read the first two volumes, it's almost a word-for-word, shot-for-shot. They leave out a thing here or there, but for the most part, it is a straight adaptation from page to screen of Precious Little Life in Versus the World, and I would assume the rest of it, because when Versus the World stops, he's about to fight with the vegan bassist, which is in the next book.
A few little touches aside, yeah, that's mostly pretty accurate.
Yeah, so. I guess I did not when I conceptualized doing this source material, I was like, okay, well, I want to see what the whole series was about, so let me start from the beginning. And then I realized, oh Christ, it's the whole thing.
hold up. I should qualify my statement a little bit. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm going to refer to this as, you know, the two separate volumes, the ones that I read, because it's just the easiest way for me to think about this. Mm-hmm. The first volume, which concludes with the fight with Matthew Patel, right, at the Battle of the Bands, and Ramona really breaking all this down like a fraction on the metro on the way home. Yes, that part is probably beat for beat the volume that the movie most closely adapts. Mm-hmm. The second volume, Scott Pilgrim versus the World, the one that yeah, as you said, it concludes right before the battle with Todd, Envy Adams' new boyfriend, and the bassist for the Clash of Demon Head. That's the one where the movie really, I don't want to say it diverts, because it still keeps the most crucial marrow of the story, but by necessity, it unfortunately has to carve away a whole lot of character development that is really uniquely satisfying about the books.
Yeah, it does away with the flashback. So you learn, you know, you get a little bit more of Scott
among other
and Kim.
Among other elements, and it's also, I think it's also the one where the kind of the tone of both Scott and Ramona and Kim, of course, especially, where that all really differs most from the movie. And God, the trickiest thing about this show is going to be saving some ammo, because a lot of this is stuff that I'm going to want to bring up on Source Material, or not Source Material, on Trial. But it's so hard not to bring it up now when we're talking about the books.
You know, in all honesty, had I known that the movie was in large part not directly word for word the entire 6-volume series, I might have restructured this entire thing as just a comic strip, and we would have just done one big show on both, because they're so closely related to each other. But
don't get me wrong, what it chooses to adapt to the screen,
mm-hmm.
it does so fucking well. Even though they had to completely rework the battle with Todd, and I understand why. Please make no mistake, I get why they had to do it. Both scenes are outstanding. But that's one of the things that makes this so impressive, and why it is practically a textbook on how to adapt something in terms of knowing what you can get away with, what matters, and how to kind of change the game plan enough to make something work without so many of the darlings that you have to kill in translation.
So volume one, Scott Pilgrim, a 23-year-old slacker, lives in Toronto with his roommate Wallace Wells. He is the bass player for Sex Bomb, an unsuccessful band consisting of himself, guitarist Steven Stills, and drummer Kim Pine. To the discomfort of Scott's friends, he has recently begun dating Knives Chow, a 17-year-old high school student. After having a dream about a woman on rollerblades, Scott encounters her in real life and discovers she is Ramona Flowers, who can travel through subspace, and has recently moved to Toronto after breaking up with a man named Gideon Graves. After Scott attempts to meet Ramona again, he receives an ominous email from someone named Matthew Patel. As Sex Bomb prepares for a concert, Matthew appears and reveals himself as the first of Ramona's evil exes. He and Scott fight a video game style battle from which Scott emerges victorious. Ramona informs Scott that if they are to date, he must defeat her 6 other evil exes, and that is the end of volume one. So, like you, I'm struggling to kind of figure out what it is I want to talk about the book versus what I want to say for when we talk about the movie. That's what makes this kind of hard in retrospect. But let me first say, I am not dumb. I get why this appeals to people. I get why this was a cultural phenomenon. It sold as many books as it did, and why it was adapted into a movie, and why the movie is beloved. I'm not saying people are wrong, and I'm not saying they don't deserve it. None of that. I will say it doesn't really appeal to me personally. After having read the first two volumes, and I really just want to like hyper focus on the first one for the sake of conversation, but having read the first two volumes and watched the movie, you know, it's fun to talk about these things. It's fun to stretch and try new things, and you know, and see, you know, what all the hype that people are telling you about a thing is all about. But you know, this first volume, kind of drilling down on that, is about this kid who he's in the mourning period of a breakup, and he's dating a 17-year-old girl very slowly and very cautiously. And when we meet him and find out about all this, just as soon as all that gets established, he is hopelessly, romantically, poetically in love with this stranger with wild hair. And I get it. I get that sort of hyper romance of it all. It's just one of those things where I'm like, I will continue to read this because I said I would, but this is not for me. And then the other side of it is, you know, so much of this deals in sort of the fun and magic of video games, and you know, it doesn't have to make realistic sense. You can do things like she travels through subspace because, you know, we're having fun times with comic books, and why not do interesting things with the medium? And I get that. And so she does, and so it's there, and then he has the fight with Patel, and it's done video game style, and he goes from slacker, ne'er-do-well, layabout, halfway decent bassist to ninja within the matter of seconds. And I'm like, this... Like, my son, when he watched the movie, was like, it's perfect. It was all the things I, you know, other than the kissing, it was all the things I could ever want in a movie, because he's super into video games. And so I get the appeal. I get the appeal. I get that watching, you know, a kid who many of us might relate to in various ways. And I do get the how people would relate to Scott Pilgrim and his character and kind of project onto him. And then him being able to be, you know, have superhero powers and fight video game style would also be appealing and fun and attractive. It made my head hurt.
Just... Really?
Yeah. You know, I... Let me say this. Just talking about the first volume, I read it, and I enjoyed the read while I was doing it, because I really tried to just forget about the movie once I realized, like, oh Christ, this is so similar. But I tried to just kind of have a positive relationship to what I was reading and kind of get through it. And you know, I enjoyed the simplicity of the art, the manga style art, the sort of juvenile style art. There are some funny jokes that are in it that made me giggle here and there. But for the most part, it was one of these things where it was like, it was very clear to me that I was not the intended audience.
Nope. Well, but I mean, really what this is, it's a stripped down, very specifically clothed hero's journey.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a complicated plot. I think that's part of what makes it so appealing, is the fact that while you might see certain elements coming, it's still this kind of cozy little blanket that you can always clothe yourself in.
May I ask you a very personal question?
You know me, of course.
Are you into the love at first sight, the hopeless romantic fictional trope?
Depending on how it's portrayed.
Okay.
And I think that's one of the things that I like so much about this.
Yep, I like
the fact that Scott is just he is the drum major leading the parade of this trope, but the reality of both his own greatest hits of bad decisions and the kind of crashing reality of the fact that it doesn't really work that way just kind of all just comes cr- comes crumbling upon his head so many times over. I kind of like the fact that he starts off and for much of the series remains fairly detestable.
I'm glad you said that, because I don't want to be hyper negative and then hit on you or somebody else a button that I shouldn't be pressing on. But I'll tell you, it's funny you say that, because as you're talking, I was like, as we're hashing out this discussion and sort of exploring, I'm like, oh Christ, this is the I like video games version of High Fidelity. Scott Pilgrim is what's his nuts from High Fidelity.
He's not quite that jaded.
Right.
But he does have that absolutely unearned bravado.
I was thinking more on how so much of his character is made up of his need to love and to be loved, which I think is what I struggle with. You know, we did a whole thing on High Fidelity last year, and we hashed that out, and I may have even said at the time, it's like, that is not a... I am fine with people who are like that, because those people who are like that have other elements to their personality, and, you know, we are all complicated, beautiful snowflakes. It's fine. Characters in a medium, whether it be a book, comic, television show, movie, tend to irritate me as a framework of a character, because they tend to be written where that's so much of what they are, there's nothing else left over to latch on to. It's just that, and that kind of pushes them through whatever the plot is. And their whole arc, if they have one, is them sort of being able to reshape that hopeless romanticism into something that makes them a better person.
For much of this series, Scott is a largely garbage fire mm-hmm. human being. Mm-hmm. And in the beginning, he is just glommed onto mm-hmm. by this bless her heart, adorable, doe-eyed, impressionable blank slate who just doesn't know any better,
right.
that perhaps the biggest, defining, most glaring reason this 23-year-old is dating a 17-year-old Chinese-Canadian schoolgirl is because no grown-ass woman has the patience to put up with his shit, or the fact that he will not get his shit together. You talk about how he's in his mourning period. No, as the rest of the supporting cast points out, this is the most disastrous, horrifying part of his mourning period. Mm-hmm. The desperate crisis in which a 23-year-old is dating a 17-year-old.
Yeah, it's the worst sort of rebound.
It's a horrendous kind of rebound. And it strikes such a chord because, man, that is so many of us
mm-hmm.
who have crashed and burned many relationships along the way.
Gosh, that's such the danger for me talking about this, because I know it's deeply personal for a lot of people. And look, I'm not saying that I left my mother's womb, immediately dated the woman I married, and we've been married for, you know, 45 years, you know, and that I haven't made my own mistakes, and I haven't, you know, had my own ups and downs with stuff like that. That's not it at all. But I mean,
look, friends, I personally have been Knives, I have been Ramona, I have been Scott. Okay. I'm pretty sure at some point in high school, perhaps, I was thinking about a couple of my earliest formative dating disasters. I was probably even young Neil a time or two.
I don't know if I was, but I definitely wanted to be Wallace.
You know what? You know what? There are certainly worse queer idols than Wallace Wells.
between Wallace and worse. Scott Pilgrim and Hugh Grant's character in The Gentleman, I definitely have my queer idols.
I adore Wallace.
I can't wait to talk about, if there's nothing else, I can't wait to talk about him and Anna Kendrick in the movie, but that's Thursday.
Oh, God, yes.
It's so hard, Sean, because I read this, and, you know, just talking about the first volume, and then we'll shift gears and talk about the second, but just to sort of put this to rest, it was like, the hopeless, I'm not saying the world should be without hopeless romantics. I think if that's the kind of thing you enjoy, relate to, project upon, like to follow, I mean, I think my daughter said it best, less kissing, more punching. It's just, you know, I'm gonna frame this so that I don't get myself in trouble or misunderstood. In terms of pure fiction and only fiction, I don't like those kinds of people. I don't enjoy following them. I'm sure he has a fantastic arc, and I'm just talking about the books now, not the movie. I'm sure he has a fantastic arc that ends with a proper hero's journey, and he is redeemed, and isn't he wonderful at the end? That's fine.
No, not entirely.
Okay, perfect, even better. But, and I'm actually interested in finishing the series at some point, but I just, this sort of wishy-washy, I'm so hyper-focused on relationships, and I don't have, I can't with these kinds of characters.
But this is why I think this is going to prove to be right up your alley.
Okay.
Is because you have a story in which you have that kind of character, and everyone from the opposite love interest to the rest of the supporting cast, mm-hmm, spares so few words in asking, is there a name for what the fuck is wrong with you?
I think you're dead on there, because I'll tell you what, that is probably the thing I enjoy most about this, is that he is surrounded by a Greek chorus of, you're a shithead, Scott.
Well, and that's the thing, and that's one of the areas where, and I promise I will elaborate on this on Thursday a little bit more, where I truly lament what Edgar Wright had no choice but to cut out of this movie, is because especially in the last few volumes, Scott truly has to come face to unflinching face with himself. We're shown kind of throughout, by way of the flashbacks especially, the various ways in which Scott has selfishly and obliviously absolutely crushed the people around him. And it's not even like he has done so en route to some kind of spectacular success. It has all been to the end of a very mediocre life. So it's not like he's really gotten anything spectacular in return about it. Out of it, I should say. In fact, it's really more like Scott is the kind who up to this point has never at any point looked just 3 seconds too long into the mirror and realized, I'm the common denominator. I have done this to myself.
Okay. We're going to take a pause for the cause here and pay some bills. Sean, how's the job working for you two these days? You get to use a little Grammarly with your writing? How about that? Do you use some Grammarly with what you got going on these days?
You know what? Constantly. And Grammarly is a tool that I wish I had at my disposal a little bit more often in my previous life as a journalist, because it's not just a spell checker. No, far from it. It is a tool, a constantly evolving, ever-present, over-your-shoulder tool that makes you a better writer. And not the nagging type. It's the kind that actually peppers your writing as you go with not so much admonishments as suggestions. Hey, you misspelled this. Oh, hey, you know, hey, you know what? These are homonyms. I think you maybe meant to use this spelling of the same word when you instead use this one. Or, that clause sounded a little bit convoluted. Let's see if we can't clean that up just a little bit.
So, as Sean is talking about here, for you listeners of Source Material Live on the Rattlegen Broadcasting Network and W2M, Grammarly is offering a free download of the Grammarly software that he was just telling you about. Grammarly's AI-powered products help people communicate more effectively, as Sean was pointing out. Grammarly helps you write mistake-free on Gmail, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and nearly anywhere else you write on the web. You want to write me hate mail saying Scott Pilgrim is the single greatest tome ever committed to paper and Rattledge, you are a fool for saying otherwise, you can use Grammarly to help you compose that tweet or email or, you know, death threat with, like, you know, magazine cutout letters, however you like. Grammarly corrects hundreds of grammar, punctuation, and spelling mistakes while also catching contextual errors, improving your vocabulary, and suggesting style improvements. To download Grammarly today, go to getgrammarly.com/W2M network. Again, that's getgrammarly.com/W2M network to download Grammarly for free. Volume 2, Scott Pilgrim versus the World, as the movie is titled. In a flashback 7 years prior, a high school age Scott forms a band with Kim and his friend Lisa Miller, and later rescues Kim when she is kidnapped by students from a rival school. In the present, Scott confronts Ramona's second evil ex, Lucas Lee, an actor and professional skateboarder shooting a movie in Toronto, who informs Scott about the League of Evil Exes. Scott is able to defeat Lucas by goading him into skateboarding and subsequently crashing down on the Baldwin steps. Scott breaks up with Knives after Wallace threatened to tell Ramona about her, though Knives later learns about Ramona and attacks her. Later, Scott receives a call from his ex-girlfriend, Envy Adams, who asks him to open for her band, The Clash at Demonhead. At the band's concert, Ramona identifies Clash at Demonhead's bassist as her ex-boyfriend, Todd Ingram. All right. I'm just going to say right off the bat, and I'll let you have at it. My favorite part of Volume 2 is the part that was not included in the movie, and that is the fight between, in the mall, I should say.
At Honest Ed's?
Yeah. Where she just attacks her out of nowhere and keeps calling her fat ass. I was dying while I was reading that. I was like, oh, this is fantastic.
Mall. Okay, I thought you meant the fight between Todd and Scott.
No. The fight between Ramona and Knives.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm sorry. And I'm even thinking ahead to, yeah, the fight I just mentioned happens in Volume 3.
Yeah. No, Scott's sister is hanging out with Ramona in the mall, and Knives attacks her with a pair of scythe, and she rips off a piece of metal tubing or whatever from an art, from, as the sister keeps saying, mall art. And they have a fight in the mall, and it's so over the top silly, but it was like an over the top silly ninja fight between two young gals and not the video game fight that we see Scott engaging in. And I kind of preferred it that way. I'm like, can't we just have a good old fashioned fist fight? So, and of course, Knives has superhuman abilities, as all the characters seem to do when the plot suits it, which is fine. I kind of just got over that. That is the style of the book. I really enjoyed that, though. I enjoyed the fight between those two. I enjoyed the dialogue exchanges. I enjoyed Knives calling Ramona fat ass every other line. You know, this sort of implied or outright said lines from Knives about, what do you got that I ain't got? I liked all of that. That was the highlight of the book for me. The opening flashback, again, not included in the movie, so I treasured it more as I was reading it, you know, about Scott getting together with Kim. You didn't want Scott Pilgrim versus the World, the movie, to be, you know, a 3 to 4 hour, you know, Justice League. So you got to cut some stuff. But I did enjoy getting some backstory on Scott and Kim. So your thoughts on Volume 2, sir?
Well, like I said, Volume 2 is where, God, I've always envisioned what the movie would have been like if so much of this could have been kept in there. And it's why, I don't want to say, it's so easy sometimes when we review some of this stuff to say that it never should have been a movie, it should have been a series. Mm. Instead, they should have just done, you know, a Western animated series or an anime or a live action series, what have you. This is one time where, as much as I love the movie, I think it would have been also cool as hell to have seen some kind of limited series that kind of pours a lot of this development in there. Because this is the volume where it becomes so much less entirely about Scott. And we start to see the process of coming to grips and moving on from through not just Scott's eyes, but through so many other journeys that are going through their characters who are going through their own shit and evolving outside of Scott's little drama. Sometimes touching upon his past, but in fact, yeah, most of the time, but a lot of times just they're also kind of grappling with the present in their own way. And in Knives' case, the poor dear, she hasn't yet realized, because she has so little of a basis of comparison, that she didn't mean remotely to Scott what Scott meant to her, in terms of being really Scott being in his own way profoundly influential and really eye-opening. And man, oh man, are there few breakups that hurt quite like realizing that you never meant to somebody else what they meant to you in the long run, and having to ultimately accept that. And that insecurity that comes with seeing someone that you were head over heels with all of a sudden being with somebody else and thinking that it's strictly a matter of them having something to offer that you didn't bring to the table, that instead of the two of you just being different, it means that you were somehow less than.
What was your favorite part about Volume 2?
Oh, God, my favorite part of Volume 2. I really loved the depiction of the backstory with Kim. The introduction of the Clash at Demonhead at the end was fantastic. The fact that O'Malley had just kind of the chill sense of humor to throw in a lovely vegan shepherd's pie recipe into the narrative.
Yeah, I find that kind of adorable.
What I would say I really liked most was the fact that this is the volume, I think, where we most start to see the difference between how Mary Elizabeth Winstead brought Ramona to life in the movie as really this kind of icy, abrasive, kind of straight-talking, larger-than-life force of nature. And Ramona seeming much more human in this, and not so much condescending towards Scott, as being, you know, kind of lovably biting, and, you know, very straightforward with him, but never really being so put off by a lot of his insecurities. She's so much more likable in this volume than I found her throughout much of the movie.
Yeah, that's for certain. I actually really agree with that. I think the Ramona presented in the book is a twinge more likable, and use the word condescending. Yeah, I think that's accurate. I think the portrayal of her in the movie versus the book is she's a bit darker, a bit more sardonic. than she is in the comic. I'll tell you, their relationship is less grating on me than in the comic than it is in the movie. I enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, in the movie, sometimes they're two such miserable people, mm-hmm. and two such sometimes they're just so generally unpleasant. You know, as opposed to the Ramona here that we see actually kind of striking up, kind of a little bit of cordial banter mm-hmm. with Stacy and the rest, Stacy and the rest of the band. Instead, in the movie, she's so perpetually armored, so constantly standoffish, that there really is no development between her and anyone else except Scott that really helps us get a bead on her. And maybe that was intentional to kind of maintain that air of kind of chilling mystery about her, that dangerous kind of unstable presence that always surrounds her, even if it's not necessarily one that she wants.
I will tell you one place where I think the movie is far superior than the book, and two is kind of a real good example of this, volume two, is anytime we're dealing with the fight scenes, mm-hmm. I think the movie, especially with Edgar Wright's direction, we'll talk a lot more about this on Thursday, but Edgar Wright has such a visual, has such an eye for, creating really visual, exciting action sequences. Mm-hmm. So just as an example, you know, the bit with the skateboarder, in the comic, it's a little flat. You know, it's a funny concept. It's, you know, it's Scott Pilgrim knowing that he's outmatched in size and strength, and so he uses his wit to trick him into doing a skateboard trick, a grind off the, you know, off this long series of staircases, and he, you know, he builds up so much speed and momentum that he blows up. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's so much better looking in the movie when it happens than in the book, and I don't think there's any way to do it in the book to make it any more exciting, you know, more exciting than the movie was. I just think that's, you know, then you're sort of a victim of the medium. You know, comics are one thing and movies are another.
I mean, the books didn't have Chris Evans in their arsenal.
This is also true. Chris Evans is fucking hilarious.
God, that man is God's gift that we deserve the least.
So anyway, is there anything either one of these volumes now? Because I think unless you got stuff on your agenda here that we hadn't talked about, I think we've sort of run the course on this conversation. Is there anything you don't like about these books? Is there anything that you're like, as far as comic books go, these could be better, and this is what could be better about them?
Not really.
Okay.
I mean, not much that you can really. And again, it's kind of like what we just joked about how, well, one of the big reasons why the Lucas Lee fight was so much better in the movie was movie had Chris Evans, books obviously don't. I feel like. And it's like the opposite of what we just talked about with how Mary Elizabeth Winstead, I can see an argument that she maybe went a little bit overboard making Ramona so unpleasant and edgy. It's kind of the opposite. I feel like in the movie, Michael Cera really drives home just kind of Scott's most insufferable traits and insecurities.
Yeah, he does.
And some of those insecurities are understandable, but they're still insufferable in ways that the writing and the interactions in the books don't always do justice. It's one of those things where I think, in a weird way, the movie almost makes the books kind of better. Because one of the laws of literature, especially literature that has been adapted, is you know that somebody has really nailed the role in another medium when you can go back and you can reread the original story, and you are hearing every scrap of dialogue in their voice. Or if you're talking about a comic or a manga, even something that's never been adapted, and you're reading it completely fresh. It happens to me all the time when I'm reading Batman in particular. Even if I'm reading something that you know, Kevin Conroy and Mark Hamill ever had a thing to do with, oh, you best believe I am hearing their voices in every bit of repartee between Batman and the Joker. And so it kind of is here. Is a lot of times the blessing, the kind of unexpected blessing of this, is that now going back and reading this, when I'm reading so much of this, I can hear Chris Evans, Aubrey Plaza, Anna Kendrick, Michael Cera, Brandon Routh, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, Brie Larson, Jason Schwartzman. You know, all these incredible. Oh God, Kieran Culkin especially.
He's so good in this.
Emily Wong, just all of them from top to bottom, and it injects such fucking not. I don't necessarily make it better, but because that would almost imply that it's superior, but it adds a whole new dimension to it. But in Scott's case in particular, again, Michael's one of those performers where he kind of only has one character he plays. It was the same knock that I kind of had on Jonah Hill for years.
And they were both in Superbad.
Well, yeah, exactly. The difference being Jonah fucked around and actually became an actor. You know, on the other hand, that's just kind of the one thing that Michael Cera really knows how to do well, no matter what he's in. In this case, it just happens to be letter perfect, though, to really drive home just how easy it is to get so fed up with Scott.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Before we go, we are going to talk about the movie at length on Thursday, and one of the things about the movie that's really cool, actually, and that I did enjoy and really don't have any complaints about, is the music. So if you look at the soundtrack, we'll talk more at length about this on Thursday. The soundtrack has some like really great bands on it. It's got the Plum Tree song that you referenced earlier. It's got some Frank Black. It's got T-Rex, the Blue Tones. It's got
Beck, the Rolling Stones. Scene.
Yeah. So the soundtrack in and of itself, plus all of these bands individually, are all available to stream on AmazonMusic.com. And if you click our link in the description, get AmazonMusic.com/W2M Network. That's GetAmazonMusic.com/W2M Network. You can get a free 30 days of Amazon Music, and you can check out all the music from Scott Pilgrim. You can check out the Animataguchi album, which we're going to review tomorrow night. You can dance if you want to, and you can leave your friends behind. You can check out all the bands that we review on the Metal Hammer of Doom, and then the ones we don't. You can check out all the bands that Sean used to do write-ups for on 401 Mania when he had that column for a little bit. You mm-hmm. can do all kinds of things. Amazon Music has almost everything you're looking for, and if you can't find it through AmazonMusic.com, you can just order the CD at Amazon. It's one-stop shopping for all your musical needs. So click our link, getamazonmusic.com/W2M Network to get a free 30 days. So Sean, I enjoyed, despite myself, I think divorced from the idea of finding interesting things to talk about with people who are passionate about talking about interesting things, I don't think I would have come to this of my own volition, but I'm not unhappy that I did. And I'll probably finish the comic book series because I am interested in seeing what all else is different from the book to the movie. I don't know when I'm going to do that, but I think, this is not exactly the Geoff Johns run on Green Lantern, which would take you a year and a half to finish. You know, this I should be able to knock this out fairly quickly in between the other things that I'm doing. So that is my intention, and I'm glad we had a chance to talk about it. I'm going to give you the last word, and then we're going to do plugs and get out of here. Go.
God, there has never been, I think, a bad adaptation or offshoot of Scott Pilgrim. I strongly recommend checking out the whole damn thing, but if you have to start somewhere, God, contrary to the whole reason we're doing this, you know, being, you know, part of the reason being the color re-release, I will absolutely die bleeding and shitting myself on the hill that the best way to experience this first and foremost is to read the original six volumes. But if you cannot do that, I actually have an alternate suggestion, and that is to make thy way over to YouTube and check out the ongoing dramatic comic dub produced by Smeef, S-M-E-E-F. They just released volume 3 about a week ago. And yeah, they are going through it in the structure of the original book releases. They are superbly voiced, littered with a mix of classic video game music, the OST, the soundtrack from the game, just a little bit of everything. The presentation is absolutely, utterly wonderful. By all means, if you cannot get your hands on a copy of the books, go and check this out.
All right. As I said, tomorrow, Scott Pilgrim Week marches on. But it's also May the 4th. May the 4th be with you, Sean. So it's Star
and
Wars.
Also with you.
So it's Star Wars Day tomorrow. You good? So it's Star Wars Day tomorrow, and with that, you know, we're always finding reasons to re-release all of our 2012, 2013 through 2016, early 2017 stuff that was on Blog Talk Radio that never made it over to W2M. So if you haven't heard it, it's new to you. And the next New to You celebrates Star Wars by our review of Rogue One, a Star Wars story. So that'll be in the archives for you to listen to tomorrow, in honor of also the release of Star Wars The Bad Batch, which starts tomorrow on May the 4th. In the evening time, myself, Sean Garmer, Sean Comer, and Jesse Starcher, we have a special Tuesday edition of The Metal Hammer of Doom. We are going to do the rare instrumental. We generally don't do this. I usually cut them from the albums. But when the whole Scott Pilgrim fiasco happened, one of the things that came out of it was Sean Garmer saying, hey, not only should you review the movie, but you should also review the soundtrack to the video game. And we were like, the what, the who, the how? And he said, the soundtrack to the video game by the Nintendo Core band, Animaniguchi. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So that's what we're going to do. Adam Maniguchi presents the Scott Pilgrim vs. the World video game soundtrack on the Metal Hammer of Doom. On Wednesday, it's Cinco de Mayo. Yet another one from our archives celebrating as such. Brujeria, Viva Presidente Trump, and Atzopachla will re-release that. That's from back in the archives. Myself and Alexis Haina will be reviewing Looney Tunes Season 1D. And then in the evening time, myself and Jesse Starcher will be reviewing Pennyworth Season 2. On Wednesday, we've got a triple threat of shows. Myself and Chris Bailey are going to kick off the day reviewing AEW Blood and Guts. Then Alexis Haina and I are going to review The Mitchells vs. The Machines, which we loved. My kids loved it. It was fantastic. Another good job by Lord and Miller. To stay away from Star Wars, okay, guys? Okay. Stick with the cartoons. And then in the evening time, Scott Pilgrim Week comes to its glorious conclusion as Sean and I will talk the movie in full with all the details, all the things we didn't get a chance to talk about tonight or stop short of talking about for Scott Pilgrim versus the World, starring the aforementioned Mary Elizabeth Winstead and Michael Cera. On Friday is our Flashback Friday episode, the DMU Hollywood Days of Future Past. On Saturday, we've got a flashback to Long Road to Ruin, the Twilight Saga, one of the infamous shows that my wife got to be on, so that was fun. And then that's it for the stuff coming up for this week. Last week, we did Vanquish, Superman Grounded Part 1, Mortal Kombat 2021, Mortal Kombat 1995, and all three TVT Mortal Kombat soundtracks. So those are all in the archives. Oh, plus, I nearly forgot the most important show that we've done in the past 2 weeks. My daughter came on Damn You Hollywood. She made her first appearance on Damn You Hollywood to talk her favorite thing, Demon Slayer, the Mugen Train movie. So her, Robert, and I all reviewed that together, and a fun time was had by all. So if nothing else, you should check out my daughter giving her opinions on Demon Slayer, the Mugen Train movie. All right, that's all I got going on. Sean, tell them how you Twitch.
Follow me on Twitter, at Comer Codex, for updates whenever I am going live and streaming. Every so often, I like to get together with a bunch of pals and chat over at twitch.tv/Comer Codex. I like to play usually Overwatch, Apex Legends, Mortal Kombat, and every so often, I like to dig out a favorite story-based franchise and run through that as well. So, by all means, follow me. Best way to keep up on when I'm going live, which is usually from about 6 p.m. Central Time until at least about 8 p.m. If I'm feeling really saucy, might extend it out to a full four-hour show.
Alrighty, that wraps it up for Source Material Live. I want to thank Sean for coming on and talking Scott.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Volumes 1 and 2. Sean, I think, is going to be back again next month. We're doing the DC Pride book when that comes out shortly thereafter. So that'll be fun. That'll be him and Alexis and me talking DC Pride for Gay Pride Month, which is the month of June. So
my first Pride Month show. I am extremely excited about this.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. All right, until then, the next week's source material is with Falcon and the Winter Soldier having just wrapped up. We'll be reviewing that next week. And the book that we're reviewing for that is one that was somewhat inspired the show, Truth, Red, White, and Black, which was the where the Isaiah character came from. So Alexis and I are going to talk, and Ben Colon, as a matter of fact, are going to talk Truth, Red, White, and Black next week on Source Material. So that'll be fun. All right, until then, for Sean Comer, you're not. I'm Mark Radulidge. Be well, be safe, and behave.